Hello, Archive members, and welcome back. Today, we're lacing up our boots and heading into one of the most famous hiking trails in the world, the Appalachian Trail. It's stretching more than 2,000 miles across the eastern United States. It's a place rich with history, breathtaking landscape, and no shortage of strange stories from centuries-old indigenous legends and regional folklore to firsthand accounts from modern hikers. We'll explore what can be documented, what remains unexplained, and why this trail continues to capture the imagination of so many people. We'd like to welcome you in to the Ominous Archives. Welcome back, everyone. I am Nick.
And I'm Em.
And like we said earlier, you ready to lace up your boots, Em?
I am.
I've been kind of itching to do the Appalachian Trail because there's just so many stories from there that just, they just, they pique my interest all the time.
It's a big one.
I don't even know if it'll be metaphorically get lost in there. You can get lost both like story-wise and actually.
Literally.
Always have your compass available. So we already said earlier that the Appalachian Trail is just about 2,200 miles long. It also stretches across 14 states. It has dense forests, rocky ridge lines, open meadows, and some of the most recognizable landscapes in the eastern U.S.
And we're covering all of it today.
We are covering it all today. Metaphorically.
When I had a whole thing planned.
Moving on.
You're getting faster at that.
I'm learning. I'm getting there, you know. So before we do get into anything strange, and there's a lot of strange, I want to take a moment to talk about what the Appalachian Trail actually is. Because I think most people kind of have a vague sense of it as a famous hiking trail. But the real history behind it is genuinely interesting.
It wasn't built just for hikers, right?
No, not originally. The idea was proposed in 1921 by a man named Benton McKay. And he wasn't thinking small. He envisioned something much larger than a recreational footpath. He imagined a network of interconnected trails and communities where people could escape the accelerated pace of industrial life, reconnect with nature, and experience the mountains in a meaningful way.
It's a beautiful idea.
Yeah, it is. And that vision inspired volunteers, hiking clubs, and government agencies to start making it real. Construction continued for more than a decade before the trail was officially completed in 1937.
And today, it's managed through a partnership between federal agencies and the Appalachian Trail Conservancy.
With thousands of volunteers every year clearing falling trees, repairing bridges, maintaining shelters, keeping the whole thing accessible. Which, given what we're about to discuss, is an enormous amount of work on behalf of the trail that has some genuinely unsettling stories attached to it.
Yeah, how many people actually hike it?
There's millions of people who visit some portion of the trail every year. Most are day hikers or weekend backpackers. But a much smaller group does attempt what's called a through hike, walking the entire trail from one end to the other in a single hiking season.
How long does that even take?
From what I've seen, anywhere from 5 to 7 months, and it's roughly 5 million steps.
5 million steps?
Yeah, give or take some.
Yeah, I literally would get winded on like step 1,000, I think. That's crazy.
We just did Universal and I got winded by like 15,000, so yeah.
I can't, yeah, my brain can't even, like, compute what 5 million steps would, like, actually look like in a day. That's crazy.
People often say it is far more difficult than they experience going in. And here's the statistic that gets me. Over the course of the entire trail, the total amount of climbing and descending adds up to the equivalent of summiting Mount Everest around 16 times.
You know what is so absolutely crazy? Right before you just said Mount Everest, I was thinking, I was like, this is giving like people like risking their lives to do Mount Everest as you say that. But that's crazy. 16 times up like.
Yeah. So it's not even just once.
Right.
This is the equivalent of going up and coming back down 16 separate times.
Yeah, I don't think I ever considered when someone says like Appalachian Trail hiking, like that's how long it would really be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a part that runs through PA, and that's kind of where I like have, I guess that's where I finally like dove in and kind of was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Just because, and I was like, I know it stretches far, but the stories get wild. So most people don't picture the fact that you're doing that like 16 times in Mount Everest. They picture just like a nice walk in the woods.
A nice walk in the woods that is apparently equivalent to 16 Mount Everest trips.
And the trail is consistently changing also. Small sections get rerouted occasionally to improve safety, protect ecosystems, reduce erosion. So the exact mileage shifts slightly from year to year. Along the route, there are more than 200 shelters, simple three-sided wooden structures where hikers can sleep to get out of the rain.
Yeah, and I'm sure those shelters have their own stories.
Those shelters very much have their own stories, which we will absolutely get into. But first, the landscape itself is extraordinary. The trail crosses national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges. It passes through some of the oldest mountains on Earth. These peaks have been worn down over hundreds of millions of years, once thought to rival the Himalayas' height.
And now they're home to black bears.
Not just black bears. We got moose, porcupines, rattlesnakes, countless birds and salamanders, and forests that seem to stretch on forever.
I feel like you buried the rattlesnakes a little. I would have led with that.
The rattlesnakes are there. They're just one item on a very long list.
Yeah, but I feel like they deserve their own little moment of acknowledgement.
Well, that's noted. The Appalachian Trail has rattlesnakes on it. There you go, Em.
Thank you.
For many people, the trail represents adventure. For others, it's personal challenge. Even a life-changing experience. But, as we'll see throughout today's episode, spending weeks or months immersed in these mountains has also led to stories that are considerably harder to explain.
What kind of stories are we talking?
Folklore that goes back centuries. First-hand encounters from modern hikers who have no explanation for what they experienced. Real tragedies, real disappearances, and a handful of cases that remain unsolved to today.
All on the same trail.
Covering that same ground from the same mountains. And before we get into any of it, there's something we need to talk about first. Because long before the Appalachian Trail, these mountains already had a history. A very long one.
Yeah, this is the part that I feel like I'm most curious about.
It's one of the most important parts of the whole episode. And I want to make sure we do it properly. So long before the Appalachian Trail existed, and long before European settlers arrived, these mountains were home to countless indigenous nations. For thousands of years, the Appalachians were homelands, trade routes, hunting grounds, and sacred landscapes.
And we're talking about a mountain range that stretches from the northeastern United States deep into the south. So we're not talking about one nation or one culture.
No, we're talking many different nations. Among them were the Cherokee in the southern Appalachians, the Shawnee and the Monacan further north, the Lenni Lenape around the Delaware Water Gap, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy in the north, the Abenaki in what is now New England, and each group had their own language, traditions, and relationship with these mountains.
And they were all connected, too.
Through an extensive network of trails that existed centuries before the first section of the Appalachian Trail was ever imagined. Routes like the Great Indian Warpath, the Unicoi Turnpike, served as major corridors for trade, diplomacy, and travel, linking communities across hundreds of miles.
And some of those ancient paths influence roads we still use today.
Some of them are still recognizable in the modern landscape, yes. And along those routes, travelers left behind traces of their presence. Stone cairns, seasonal shelters, trees that were intentionally shaped to point toward water or safe passage, which is kind of cool.
That's a detail that definitely gets me. Trees that are literally there to give you directions.
Specifically point towards the water.
It's kind of sick.
Yeah. To think you'd, like, if you didn't know about it, we'd just be walking the trail and be like, oh, that tree's pointed kind of cool.
Right, like, huh.
No idea that it's pointing towards water. Boy, that's why you should do your research before you do any kind of hiking or backpacking. Living signposts in a landscape that could otherwise be very difficult to navigate. And many places along what is now the Appalachian Trail held deep spiritual significance. Certain peaks were regarded as sacred, places where ceremonies were performed or visions were sought.
The Cherokee connection to Clingman's Dome.
The Cherokee considered Kauai, today known as Clingman's Dome, to be a piece of real spiritual importance. And the Abenaki believe some of the highest summits in the Northeast were the dwelling places of powerful spirits. They traditionally avoided climbing beyond the tree line out of respect.
Which is crazy, not out of fear necessarily, but out of respect.
That distinction does matter too. And European settlement dramatically changed that relationship. Diseases introduced through early contact devastated indigenous communities. Ancestral lands were steadily taken or encroached upon despite repeated promises to protect.
And then the Trail of Tears.
Following the passage of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, thousands of Cherokee, Muscogee, Chickasaw, and Choctaw, and Seminole people were forcibly removed from their homelands in the Southeast. Beginning in 1838, Cherokee families were rounded up, held in internment camps, and forced to march west to what is now Oklahoma. Thousands died from disease, starvation, and exposure along the way. Remember when we covered, it was one of the lakes. I want to say Lake Lanier. I think that was in the South.
Mm-hmm.
There was a trail.
Yeah.
That the that they forced Indians to walk on. I think that's tied to this.
I wouldn't.
I think it's
surprised.
the same trail.
Yeah.
So.
And the routes that they were forced to travel during that time
followed the same ancient mountain pathway their communities had traveled for generations. Same trails, the same mountains, under completely different circumstances.
Yeah, that's a weight that I feel like definitely wouldn't go away.
And it's important to say clearly, not everyone was removed. Some Cherokee families remained hidden in the rugged mountains of western North Carolina. Their descendants are now part of the eastern band of Cherokee Indians who continue to preserve their language, their traditions, and their connections to these mountains to today.
Which is honestly remarkable given everything.
It's genuinely remarkable. Among those preserved traditions are some of the oldest stories ever associated with these mountains. And I want to be clear about something before we get into them.
Yeah, these aren't campfire stories.
They are not campfire entertainment. They were never intended as ghost stories for hikers to share over a fire. These accounts are part of larger cultural and spiritual traditions passed down through generations to explain the world, preserve history, and teach important lessons. Some beliefs remain private or sacred, and we're going to respect that. But a handful of figures have been documented by historians, folklorists, and Cherokee storytellers over the years, and they're worth discussing with the care that they deserve.
Starting with Spearfinger.
Spearfinger, whose name roughly translates to "she who had it sharp." And this is one of the most well-known figures in Cherokee tradition. Spearfinger was a powerful, shape-shifting being who wandered the mountains disguised as an elderly woman.
The disguise is the thing that makes this one very unsettling to me.
Because she doesn't come off dangerous. She looks like someone who might need help. Her most recognizable feature was a single razor-sharp finger made of stone, which she used to kill her victims with remarkable precision.
She was also nearly impossible to injure.
She had stone-like skin, nearly invulnerable, with only one hidden weakness. And many versions of the story place her in the mountains of western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee. Landscapes that today are crossed by southern stretches of the Appalachian Trail.
So hikers walking through those sections are walking through her territory, according to tradition.
Yeah, according to the tradition. And if Spearfinger was feared for hunting the living, the next figure was feared for something even more specific.
The Raven Mocker.
The Raven Mocker, described as a supernatural being that appeared human by day, but at night, it traveled in search of those nearing death.
Not the healthy, the dying.
Specifically those who were already close to death. Cherokee tradition holds that the Raven Mocker could steal the remaining years of a dying person's life, extending its own existence in the process.
It's a deeply disturbing concept, actually. It's not just like killing, it's literally theft, taking what's left of somebody's time.
And its approach was said to be marked by eerie cries echoing through the mountains, streaks of light crossing the night sky. One of the most feared figures in Cherokee belief, not because of the physical violence, but because of what it represented, the violation of a person's final moments.
Yeah, that one lands a little differently than a lot of what we cover, I feel.
It really does. The next figure is a little different in character. The Moon-Eyed People.
These ones are more mysterious than frightening, I feel.
Yeah. They definitely are. It makes me think of the Black Eyed Kids, but mm-hmm. I feel like they are more... I wouldn't use the word like spooky, but, you know.
Ah, the Becks.
Early accounts recorded from the Cherokee tradition describe Moon-Eyed People as a mysterious group of pale, human-like people who supposedly inhabited parts of the Southern Appalachian Trails before the Cherokee arrived. They were said to have unusual light-sensitive eyes, making daylight difficult for them and leading them to travel primarily at night.
Which is where the name comes from.
And they're only comfortable in darkness. The historians have proposed a wide variety of explanations. Misunderstandings of earlier indigenous cultures, later colonial myths, other theories entirely. No single explanation has been widely accepted.
They just exist in the record, unexplained.
Unexplained and genuinely difficult to categorize. And the last tradition I want to touch on is the Little People.
Which I think is the one most people might be tempted to dismiss and probably shouldn't.
I think you're right on that one. The Little People are described as small, human-like beings living among the mountains, caves, and dense forests. They are not portrayed as inherently good or evil, which I think is what makes them interesting.
They respond to how you behave.
Cherokee tradition presents them as powerful and unpredictable, responding to people in ways that reflect how those people themselves behave. Some stories describe them guiding lost travelers or sharing knowledge. Others tell of them leading disrespectful visitors astray and causing mischief in the woods.
So they're not really monsters. They're more of a mirror.
That's a really good way to put it. And even today, stories of little people remain part of the Cherokee oral tradition, shared with great respect by many who preserve these cultural teachings. These aren't relics of the past belief system. They're living stories belonging to living communities.
And I think that's worth sitting with for a second before we move into the broader trail folklore, because a lot of what follows, hints, ghost lights, phantom hikers, that's a different category entirely. Regional folklore that developed over centuries of European settlement and gradually got layered into these mountains.
A completely different tradition. Different origins, different purposes. Both deserve to be understood on their own terms rather than mixed together in one general category of spooky Appalachian stuff.
Okay, so speaking of the broader folklore.
Let's talk about what follows hikers up the trail. So hikers make their way along the Appalachian Trail. They're moving through hundreds of years of regional folklore, some of it brought to America by European settlers and gradually woven into the Appalachian culture over the centuries. And hikers themselves have added their own experiences on top of that, creating a tapestry of legends that keeps growing.
So where do we start?
We're going to start with a word, because there's one word more closely associated with the Appalachian folklore than any other. Haint, which is generally understood to mean a restless spirit. Someone who died violently, suffered an injustice, or left something unfinished in life. And unlike the traditional image of a ghost wandering aimlessly, a haint is believed to remain tied to a specific place, an abandoned cabin, a lonely mountain hollow, an old cemetery, sometimes even a single tree that locals refuse to disturb.
And there's an actual physical tradition connected to haints, too.
Haint blue. Throughout Appalachia and much of the American South, historic homes often feature porch ceilings or window frames painted a pale blue-green.
And I've seen that and never knew that it meant something.
Same. According to traditions, the color resembles either water or the open sky, confusing wandering spirits and preventing them from entering a home. Haints apparently can't cross water and mistake the painted surface for the real thing.
So it's essentially a supernatural no-entry sign painted on your porch or ceiling.
Pretty much, it's kind of like the salt in the doorway.
Yeah.
And many homeowners still continue to practice today, whether they believe the folklore or simply appreciate the history.
I respect it. It's practical and decorative.
Haunting prevention that also looks nice. As the trail winds through the mountains, another figure keeps appearing in local stories. And this one has a very specific presence.
The Black Dog.
Now, this legend has roots in British and Scots-Irish folklore. Brought to Appalachia by early immigrants and adapted to the mountain landscape, witnesses describe an enormous black dog standing silently at the edge of the trail or watching them from the tree line. Eyes often described as glowing red or yellow.
That's already deeply unpleasant.
And here's what makes it different from most supernatural creature legends. The black dog rarely attacks.
It just watches.
It serves as an omen. Many stories claim that encountering the black dog is a warning, a sign that danger lies ahead, or that someone nearby may soon die. Hikers who ignore its silent presence continue down the trail and can encounter severe storms, accidents, or other misfortunes.
So it's less of a monster and more of a very unsettling advance notice system.
Yeah, one that you can't unsubscribe from.
No opt out on the Black Dog warning service.
None whatsoever. And the legend has remained remarkably consistent throughout the Appalachian region, which, given how much folklore tends to shift and change over time, says something about how serious people take it.
All right, so what's next?
Granny magic.
Oh, I like this one.
For generations, isolated mountain communities relied on individuals known as granny women or granny doctors. These were respected healers who combined herbal remedies, practical medicine, Christian faith, and generations of local knowledge to care for their neighbors, long before the hospitals or physicians were anywhere nearby.
And they were genuinely skilled.
They really were. They would use medicinal plants, dowsing rods, and what some called the sight to diagnose illnesses, predict changing weather, locate lost livestock. Deeply respected members of their communities.
But folklore always needs a shadow version of things.
It does. Mountain legends also tell of a woman who's supposedly used similar knowledge for darker purposes. These were the mountain witches, said to take the form of rabbits, deer, or other animals under the cover of night, accused of bringing nightmares, spoiling crops, stealing milk from dairy cows, placing curses on neighboring families.
The spoiling crops one is interesting because it's such a practical concern. Like, someone's crops fail and the easiest explanation is the suspicious woman on the hill.
That tells you a lot about how those accusations were probably generated. Someone needed an explanation for misfortune and folklore provided one.
Always the woman on the hill.
Whether those accusations reflected genuine belief or simple suspicion is impossible to know today. But mountain witch stories remain deeply rooted in Appalachian folklore either way.
Okay, ghost lights, because I've been waiting for this one.
All right. Well, the Brown Mountain Lights are one of the most enduring mysteries of the Appalachian folklore. In western North Carolina, not far from the Appalachian Trail corridor, observers have reported mysterious lights rising above Brown Mountain near the Linville Gorge for more than a century.
What do they look like?
Witnesses describe white, blue, red, and orange lights drifting silently across the landscape before suddenly disappearing. And explanations vary widely.
Okay, Cherokee tradition first.
So that tells of spirits searching the mountains after an ancient battle. Another local legend describes someone endlessly searching for a lost companion, carrying the lantern through the darkness forever.
And then science got involved.
Scientists have studied the phenomenon for decades. Early investigators suggested the distant trains or automobile headlights refracted by unusual atmospheric conditions. But here's the thing. Reports of lights predate both automobiles and widespread electrification in the region.
So the conventional explanation doesn't actually cover all the sightings.
It doesn't cover any of the earliest ones. More recent theories include ball lighting, temperature inversions, naturally occurring geological and atmospheric conditions. Despite numerous investigations, no single explanation has accounted for every reported sighting.
It's another enduring mystery that just keeps going.
All right, on to the Boojum.
Oh, I love the Boojum. I just like the name, honestly.
Hidden in the rugged peaks of western North Carolina, specifically the Platte Bezlam Mountains, is the legend of the Boojum. A regional Bigfoot-like creature said to inhabit the area.
All right, well, describe it.
Well, we're looking about 8 feet tall, perfect, covered in thick fur, capable of producing an eerie, mournful cry that echoes through the surrounding valley.
Terrifying, but yet.
The Boojum isn't known for attacking people.
It's simply just nosy.
intensely curious. Think of the Bigfoot from a Goofy movie.
Yeah.
Stories portray it as wandering through campsites. And here's the detail I love. If cookware, gemstones, tools, or even a jug of moonshine disappear overnight,
they just chalk it up to the Boojum took it.
The Boojum may have wandered through camp.
An 8-foot fur-covered creature who steals moonshine and cooking pots. I respect it.
Whether told seriously or with a smile around a campfire, the Boojum has become one of the most enduring pieces of mountain folklore.
Can we get an entire episode on the Boojum, actually?
You just have your next episode. Now we have phantom hikers. Because this is where it gets genuinely atmospheric.
All right, tell me about it.
Long-distance backpackers occasionally describe encountering another person on the trail who seems completely ordinary at first. They exchange a greeting, step aside to pass, continue walking. And when they glance back moments later,
the other hiker is gone.
The best-known example comes from the area around Grandfather Mountain in North Carolina. Witnesses describe an older man wearing 19th century work clothes, carrying a heavy canvas pack and a walking stick. He rarely speaks. He passes with a nod before disappearing around the next bend.
And then he's just not there.
Not around the bend. Not anywhere. Just gone.
That specific detail, the 19th century work clothes, is what makes it feel real to me. Like, if someone was making it up, I feel like they'd describe something more dramatically supernatural.
How specific it is what always gets me with these accounts. And whether these stories are misidentifications, memory tricks, or something else, they continue to circulate among through hikers today, passed from one generation of hikers to the next.
All right, let's go back to the shelters now.
So the shelters. The Appalachian Trail has more than 250 shelters where hikers can spend the night. They're simple wooden structures. Most are nothing more than protection from the weather.
But a few have reputations.
A few very much have reputations. In Virginia, Sarver Hollow Shelter stands near the remains of an isolated 19th century homestead. Visitors report hearing footsteps crossing the roof after dark, the sound of an old grinding stone turning in the distance, and the occasional appearance of a pale figure near the former home's foundation.
Yeah, I certainly would not be staying at Sarver Hollow Shelter.
Now we're going to bring it to PA.
Oh, great.
Because the Black Log Mountain has become associated with reports of overwhelming dread, sudden drops in temperature, and the sensation of heavy footsteps following hikers just beyond the reach of their headlamps.
Just beyond the headlamp. That specific distance is the worst part of that description.
It's close enough to hear, but too dark to see. And in Maryland, the trail passes through Gathlin State Park near Burkesville.
Blair Witch territory.
It is very much Blair Witch territory. But with a much longer history than that film. The area has deep Civil War connections, and some hikers have reported hearing distant battle cries, groans, or seeing unexplained figures near Crampton Gap after dark.
Civil War left a lot of places feeling heavy. That one honestly doesn't surprise me that much.
Nope. I still say when you go to Gettysburg, if you just sit there and take it in for a moment, you'll feel it.
Yeah.
Finally, we have Vermont. The trail skirts a region known as the Bennington Triangle, centered around Glastonbury Mountain, an area that became infamous after several unexplained disappearances in the 1940s.
And hikers still report things there.
An unusual silence settling over the forest, dense fog appearing without warning, an overwhelming feeling of no longer being alone.
That last one keeps coming up, doesn't it? across completely different locations, completely different people.
Mm-hmm. That consistency across people who've never met, reporting similar experiences in different parts of a 2,000-mile trail is actually what we're going to dig into next.
First-hand accounts.
The modern hikers, the people who weren't looking for a ghost story and found something they still can't explain. All right, so here's the thing about this next section. I want to be upfront about. Legends and folklore are one thing. First-hand experiences are another.
These aren't old stories passed down over generations.
Nah, these come from modern hikers, backpackers, campers, people who shared their experiences in the trail journals, ranger reports, long-distance hiking forums. Some have become part of the oral tradition passed between hikers on the trail itself.
And none of it proves anything supernatural.
None of it. Many of these experiences probably have perfectly ordinary explanations. But what I find genuinely interesting isn't necessarily whether any of it is paranormal. It's how often similar stories appear from people who've never met one another.
The consistency again.
It's always super consistent. So let's start with one of the most commonly reported experiences on the trail. Hearing voices where no one should be.
This one makes my skin crawl a little.
So some hikers describe hearing their name called from somewhere just off the trail. And the voice often belongs to someone they know. A hiking partner, a spouse, a close friend, Puckwudgie.
Which is specific enough that it's hard to dismiss as just wind or acoustics.
Right, because wind doesn't know your name. And the strange part comes when they investigate or contact that person, only discover they were nowhere nearby. Some weren't even on the trail.
So you hear your friend's voice in the woods, you call them later, and they were at home the whole time.
Yeah, and then there's the night version of this. Hikers settling into camps describe hearing what sounds like several people quietly talking just beyond the trees. The conversation sounds completely ordinary, normal in every way, but the words themselves are impossible to understand.
I imagine it's like hearing a conversation through a wall.
Yeah, if you think about it. And curious hikers, they'll step outside expecting to find another campsite nearby. And they only find silence, an empty forest, no one around.
That specific experience, the ordinary sounding conversation that you can't quite make out, is somehow worse than something overtly strange.
Because your brain already decided it's normal before you realize there's no explanation for it. On to the feeling of being watched.
This one, I think a lot of people have experienced in the woods, even without any paranormal context.
Many experienced hikers describe a sudden sensation of no longer being alone. And the experience often begins with the forest itself, before they feel anything.
It's the quiet.
Wind fades, birds stop singing, even insects fall silent. Researchers sometimes refer to this kind of environmental quiet as the Oz effect, a term used to describe the abrupt absence of normal background sounds before an unusual experience.
And then almost immediately after the quiet,
there is an overwhelming feeling something unseen is watching. And what I find interesting about the accounts is how consistent the response is. Even people with decades of wilderness experience describe an instinctive urge to leave the area immediately, without investigating, without trying to identify what might be there.
Which is notable because experienced hikers don't usually spook that easily.
They really don't. They're pretty rock solid when it comes to stuff like that. Many of them can't explain afterward why they felt the need to move. They just knew they didn't want to stay.
Yeah, that's something older than logic kicking in.
something the body knows before the brain can catch up. And then as daylight fades, another reoccurring report starts appearing.
Shadow figures.
What would this place be without shadow figures? Some hikers describe seeing what appears to be a person standing perfectly still among the trees. Now, at first glance, it looks like another hiker. But as they keep watching, they realize something is wrong.
Wrong how?
Witnesses describe these figures as unnaturally dark, as though they absorb light rather than reflect it. They don't move like people or wildlife. And when illuminated with a flashlight,
they disappear.
They seem to glide behind a tree or vanish altogether. Without the sounds you'd normally expect in a forest, no snapping branches, no rustling leaves, they're just gone.
The no sound part is what does it for me, because even if you can explain away the visual, a person, a shadow, a trick of the light, you can't explain the absence of sound when something moves through dense forests.
Something moving through trees makes noise. Always. Unless apparently it doesn't.
Yeah.
Missing time, which is rarer, but among the most unsettling reports from the trail. I feel like all kinds of like national parks and stuff like that have the missing time thing.
Yeah, like time slips or yeah. Like...
I feel like there's just a thing about the national parks.
Well, what are the hikers describing?
Walking what should have been a short stretch of the trail, only to discover that several hours have somehow passed. They don't remember stopping to rest. They don't remember becoming lost. They don't remember falling asleep. To them, the hike felt completely normal.
And then they check their watch.
And then they check their watch or their GPS or their phone. And far more time has passed than they perceived. Others describe a brief moment of disorientation, sometimes a faint humming sound before the realization hits.
The humming detail is specific enough that it keeps coming up separately in different accounts.
Different people, different locations, different years, same humming, and there are many possible explanations. There's fatigue, dehydration, lapses in attention. The trail is genuinely exhausting, and the mind does strange things under physical stress.
But the people who experience it describe something that feels categorically different from just losing track of time.
Deeply unsettling is the phrase that comes up again and again. Not confused, not embarrassed, unsettled in a way that stays with them.
Okay, so what about the animals?
So, we talked earlier about how the Appalachian is home to black bears. We have coyotes, bobcats, deer, and countless other species.
Do not forget about the rattlesnakes.
Wildlife encounters are completely expected, but occasionally hikers describe the behavior that seems off.
Off how?
Like predators standing motionless and silent, not displaying typical signs of fear or aggression, just watching calmly for an unusual amount of time.
Which goes against how predators typically behave around humans.
Typically, they'll want to leave. They don't want to be seen. And then there are deer and smaller animals described as moving with stiff, awkward gaits that don't resemble normal movement. Like something wearing the animal rather than being the animal.
Yeah, that specific description is unsettling for me.
It gets me too. Because it's just a weird thing to think about.
It's like uncanny vibes. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like that.
Yeah, it's almost like the Outsider, if you ever read that, from Stephen King.
Mm.
Or the show. I didn't finish the show. But anyway, back to the point. could be an illness or an injury, which could account for some of these encounters. But they leave a lasting impression on people who witness them regardless of that explanation.
And then the sounds.
Mountains have always been known for strange acoustics. Sound travels surprising distances through the valleys, making it difficult to determine where a noise actually originated. But certain reports keep standing out.
A knocking.
A slow, rhythmic knocking echoing through the forest. Witnesses insist it doesn't resemble a woodpecker. They compare it to someone striking a tree with a heavy piece of lumber. It's kind of like that clunk. Did you ever hit like two pieces of wood together and hit that clunk? Yeah, that.
Yeah, and some people say that it responds.
Some claim the knocks seem to answer their own movements in an almost conversational pattern.
Which implies something's paying attention.
And others describe hearing distant industrial sounds like metal grinding, machinery operating, even what resembles a train horn, despite being miles from the nearest road, railroad, or town.
The train horn one is strange because that's not something you'd normally mistake for just a natural sound.
And it's not something the forest producers talk about, train horn. You hear it?
I was just going to say, that's such wild timing.
Yeah, it was really good timing. There's a train that runs by my house, and we can currently hear it as we're talking about the train horn.
As we just talked about it.
So no, you can't mistake that. Many of these likely have natural explanations rooted in terrain and weather and acoustics. The mountains are strange that way, but others remain exactly what they were when first reported. Unusual experiences that the people who heard them have never forgotten.
And what I keep coming back to across all of these, the voices, the figures, the missing time, the sounds, is that these aren't people who went to the trail looking for a paranormal experience.
Most of them weren't thinking about any of this at all. They were just on it for hiking.
They were literally just hiking, and something happened that they still can't explain years later.
Which is a different kind of compelling than a legend someone passed down deliberately. These are people trying to describe something that happened to them and struggling to find words for it.
Okay, the next section is heavier.
It is, because not every unsettling story connected to the Appalachian Trail belongs to folklore or unexplained experiences. Some of them are simply real, and they deserve to be treated that way.
The dark history.
So we need to talk about the real history of the Appalachian Trail. And I want to say up front, over the last century, millions of people have safely hiked portions of the trail. For the overwhelming majority, it remains an incredible outdoor experience.
That context matters.
It does, because the trail has also witnessed real violence, tragic accidents, and disappearances that remind us how unforgiving the wilderness can be. And those stories deserve to be told accurately rather than sensationalized.
Starting with the murders.
Murders on the Appalachian Trail are exceptionally rare, given millions of visitors it receives each year. But a handful of cases have left a lasting impact on the hiking community. And the most infamous name associated with trail violence is Randall Lee Smith.
Virginia, 1981.
In May of 1981, Smith befriended two thru-hikers near Parrisburg, Virginia. Their names were Robert Mumford Jr. and Laura Susan Ramsey. After gaining their trust, he murdered both of them near Wapiti Shelter.
He befriended them first, and that's a detail that makes it so much worse.
Yeah, he gained their trust, and Smith later pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and received a 30-year prison sentence. However, after serving roughly half that time, he was released on parole in 1996.
Which is where the story should have ended.
And it didn't. In May of 08, Smith returned to the very same area near Whippity Shelter. He opened fire on two fishermen named Scott Johnson and Sean Farmer.
The same location.
The same area where he had killed two people 27 years earlier. Both Johnson and Farmer survived. They escaped the attack. Smith fled, crashed his vehicle during a police pursuit, and was taken into custody. He died later that year while awaiting trial.
There's something about that fact that he went back to the same place that I find particularly disturbing, and watching enough true crime in my life tells me that, like, that area definitely means something to that man.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of those details that'll sit with you.
Yeah.
And then there's a case that haunted investigators for nearly 30 years. Julie Williams and Lolly Winnis.
This one's important to get right.
In May of 1996, the couple was camping near the Appalachian Trail in Virginia's Shenandoah National Park. They were murdered. Their bodies were discovered several days later, and for years, the investigation struggled to find answers.
Finally, in 2002, charges were filed.
Prosecutors charged a man named Darryl David Rice, believing that he had targeted the women because they were lesbians. But the charges were later dismissed after investigators determined that there wasn't sufficient forensic evidence to proceed.
And the case sat unsolved for nearly 30 years.
And then, in 2024, advances in DNA technology finally provided an answer. Federal investigators announced that biological evidence from the crime scene matched Walter Leo Jackson III, a convicted serial rapist who had died in prison years earlier.
Perfect, so he could never be prosecuted.
He couldn't. But the announcement gave investigators, and more importantly, victim families, a measure of long-awaited closure after almost three decades.
It's a really long time to have to wait for an answer.
Yeah, and these cases, as rare as they are, change how hiking communities think about safety on the trail, particularly for solo hikers.
Okay, so what about Geraldine Largay?
This one is different from the murders. It's not a crime. It's a survival case. And I think it's one of the most important stories connected to the trail because of what it teaches.
July 2013.
Geraldine Largay was 66 years old, a through hiker. In July of 2013, she stepped back off the trail in Maine to use the bathroom. And she never found her way back.
A simple, ordinary moment.
The most ordinary thing imaginable. An extensive search involving hundreds of volunteers failed to locate her. For 2 years, nothing.
And then a land surveyor found her campsite.
2 years later, less than a mile from the trail itself, and what the discovery revealed was heartbreaking. Largay survived for 26 days.
26 days less than a mile away.
Her journal documented her repeated attempts to contact rescuers, her growing realization that she had become hopelessly lost, even though she was only a short distance from one of America's best-known hiking trails.
The journal is what makes this one so devastating, because you're reading someone process what's happening to them in real time.
Day by day. And her story is now used in wilderness survival courses as an example of how quickly disorientation can occur, even for experienced hikers in familiar terrain.
Because the lesson isn't that she did something foolish, it's that the wilderness doesn't require you to make a big mistake. A small one is more than enough.
A dense forest, poor cell reception, no landmarks, and suddenly a mile feels like 100.
Yeah, I feel like that one sits with me a little differently than anything else we've covered today.
Okay. Missing hikers, more broadly, because disappearances on the trail receive a lot of public attention, and it's important to keep them in perspective.
The trail spans 14 states managed by numerous different agencies.
Which means there's no single database tracking every missing person report. But available information from the National Park Service and the Appalachian Trail Conservancy indicates that the vast majority of missing hikers are located within a few days.
Dead phone batteries, poor cell reception, unexpected injuries, hiking more slowly than planned.
All of which can make someone appear overdue without anything truly sinister happening. And then there's the missing 411 phenomena, which we should address honestly.
Because it comes up in any conversation about the trail disappearances.
Beginning in 2012, author David Pallades compiled hundreds of cases involving people who disappeared on public lands, arguing that many shared unusual patterns that couldn't easily be explained. The book developed a large following and introduced many readers to search and rescue cases they otherwise might have never heard about.
And the criticism?
The series has drawn substantial criticism from investigators, journalists, and search and rescue professionals. Critics argue that many cases omit important context, weather conditions, medical history, mental health issues, navigational errors, and evidence uncovered during official investigations. Disappearances presented as unexplained may have far more conventional explanations than the book suggests.
Which doesn't mean every case has a simple answer, but it means the framing matters.
Yeah, it matters enormously. And I think the honest position is, the Appalachian Trail doesn't need speculation to command respect. Between its difficult terrain, unpredictable weather, and sheer remoteness, it remains a place where small mistakes can have life-changing consequences.
You don't need a supernatural explanation to find the trail genuinely formidable.
You really don't. And I think it's actually the most important thing we can say in this section. The trail is extraordinary and beautiful and worth experiencing. And it demands that you take it seriously.
Geraldine Largay took it seriously and it still happened.
Which is the hardest lesson of all. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground today. The history, the indigenous traditions, the folklore, the firsthand accounts, the real tragedies, and the last thing I want to do is try to make sense of all of it.
What can actually be proven?
And where the honest answer is. We just don't know. So, after everything we've covered today, the history, the traditions, the folklore, the firsthand accounts and tragedies, I want to do something that we don't always do at the end of an episode. I want to be honest about what we actually know.
What can be documented versus what can't.
Exactly. So let's start this with what is historically documented. The Appalachian Trail has a well-recorded history from Benton Mackey's original proposal in 1921 to its completion in 1937. The indigenous nations we discussed have called these mountains home for thousands of years, and many of their traditions are actively preserved and shared by their descendants today.
Not past tense, present tense.
Living communities, living traditions, and the real tragedies we covered. The Trail of Tears, the murders, the disappearances, the story of Geraldine Largay. Those are matters of historical record. They don't require embellishment. They're reminders that the Appalachian wilderness can be both beautiful and devastating.
Sometimes in the same place.
Sometimes on the same day. Now, some of the phenomena reported along the trail also have plausible natural explanations. The Brown Mountain Lights have been studied for well over a century, proposed explanations include distant lights distorted by atmospheric conditions, ball lighting, geological and metaphorical processes. No single theory explains every sighting, but researchers do continue to investigate.
And the environment itself accounts for a lot.
The mountains create unusual echoes, sound travels surprising distances and in unexpected directions, fatigue, sleep deprivation, isolation, changing weather, all of these generally influence how we perceive our surroundings. A mind under physical stress is an unfamiliar environment. In an unfamiliar environment is going to interpret things differently than a rested mind in a familiar one.
Which doesn't invalidate the experience, it just contextualizes them.
And then there are things that don't fit neatly into either category.
The voices that seem to come from nowhere.
The silent hikers who disappear around the next bend. The overwhelming feeling of being watched in a forest that has just gone completely quiet. The shadow figures glimpsed between the trees. The missing time. The encounters that leave people convinced they witnessed something they still can't explain years later.
And the honest answer is...
that doesn't automatically make them paranormal. It simply means we don't have enough evidence to say confidently what happened. And maybe that's actually what makes the Appalachian Trail so ominous.
It's not one thing. It's never been one thing.
It's 2,000 miles of ancient mountains, 600 years of layered history, thousands of years of indigenous presence, generations of folklore, millions of individual human experiences. And somewhere in all of that, a small number of things that resist explanation.
Some stories can be verified, some can be reasonably explained, and a small number remain unresolved.
Not because they're proof of the supernatural, but because every so often, people encounter something they can't easily put into words, and they carry it with them long after they've left the mountains.
That's the trail, isn't it? People always carry something out that they didn't bring in.
Yeah. That might be the most accurate thing anyone's probably said about it.
I've been known to have my moments.
You've been known to have some moments. So before we close it out, the Appalachian Trail isn't mysterious because of a single ghost story or an unsolved disappearance. It's mysterious because nearly every generation has added another layer to its history. Indigenous traditions, pioneer folklore, Civil War history, hikers, journals, true crime, search and rescue cases, and modern firsthand accounts have all become a part of the same landscape. Whether every story has a supernatural explanation is almost besides the point. The trail has become a living archive of people who've crossed it and the experiences they chose to share. That's what makes it such a compelling place to study. So this episode was written by Samantha from Scare Me Sam. If you are looking for a dark fantasy book or horror thriller, go check her out over at Scare Me Sam. She does great work for us. She does great work for herself. She is just pretty good.
Great all around.
Yeah. And don't forget to go and follow us on the Ominous Archives, our social medias, email us. Check out our store if you want. I guess that's it. Time to go to bed. Dogs are tired.
I'm tired.
So, archive members, as always, stay weird and stay haunted. See ya.
See ya.